I think I've become slightly more perfect than I was as we went into that break anyway. I've done some work on myself. You know, speaking of all that, speaking of these, the kind of philosophical quest that I happen to be speaking of, Rush, Hideous Fathead Rush, I was listening to him today, and he was once again attempting to deal with the issue of whether or not he is a hypocrite. And here's why, and here's how. He basically said, the question is Rush a hypocrite in the sense that he's condemned people for using illegal drugs, said that people who purchase and use illegal drugs illegally should go to prison, et cetera, et cetera, and then he went and did it. And he says, interestingly, he says, no, he's not a hypocrite.
Yeah.
And
it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. And then he says, the reason, and you have to follow this closely, it's complex. It's complex.
Sure it is.
Tickets, all right? The reason that he's not a hypocrite is as follows. And here it is, and what it is, too. Because, in fact, there is such a thing as right and wrong, and right versus wrong. And he, you know, those are platonic ideals, platonic concepts for Rush. And he was pointing those out. He was pointing those out. And he was pointing out to people what's right and what's wrong. Now, the fact that he went up and did the wrong thing doesn't make him a hypocrite. Because he has to be able to point out the difference between right and wrong, even though he occasionally does the wrong thing. And very quickly, I don't have some interesting looking calls on the...
No, we don't.
Not really, but... So I might run this... I mean, just plug something else into it. Just, you know, since it's Rush, you should plug Bill Clinton. It's as if the argument were that Bill Clinton... If Bill Clinton, in his inaugural address, had made it clear that it is wrong and despicable to have oral sex with White House interns when you are a married man, and then proceeded to do that later on, it wouldn't be wrong because he was correct during his inaugural address in pointing out that it is wrong to do that, assuming that...
So it's merely just the labeling of right and wrong.
Well, yeah, on the one hand, it's anybody's obligation, according to Rush, to point out the difference between right and wrong.
Point out what's wrong,
yeah.
And then if you do it, that's not wrong.
No, that doesn't make you a hypocrite, apparently. I'm not really sure what does make you a hypocrite, but that's not...
That would make an interesting... college course.
It's almost impossible to achieve hypocrisy under the Rush Limbaugh system. I'd like to point that out. I was trying to work it out here. I took a fair amount of philosophy in college. I was trying to work out how you could be a hypocrite, and it's almost impossible. What you would have to do is identify things that weren't really right or wrong, and then do the... Well, no, it doesn't work. And say they were right versus wrong, and then do the... You can't be a hypocrite.
Yeah.
He's eliminated that very concept. Anyway, huh? Listen, yep, thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay, still talk. Bye-bye. That was fun. That was very enjoyable. I guess Bill's not with CNN anymore?
I don't know.
Is that what he said? That could be why. He said he used to be with CNN. I didn't know he,
I didn't know he was with CNN.
Yeah, well, I think he said he used to be with CNN.
Maybe he was just making
a little joke about
it. Yeah, something like that.
Didn't sound very happy. He sounded, it was a darker Bill Tush than I remember.
Right. He sounded much happier the last time he was here.
Well, boy, he really did sound kind of, dated and... I don't know.
What are you trying to say?
I don't know.
You might as well just come out and say it.
No, he sounded darker and more cynical and depressed and angry and bitter. And alone and helpless and afraid and drunk.
There you go.
I don't know. I was just piling adjectives on there. I'm not really saying he sounded any worse. But there was something wrong. And you know what I didn't do? I didn't reach out to Bill. I didn't say, Bill, what's wrong?
Can we help? You didn't say, can we help?
Bill, I don't even know you anymore. What's happening? I didn't say that. Now, I've only ever talked to Bill once before in my life, so it might have been inappropriate.
It gets bad when you have to have an intervention, for the guest.
For the guest. Yeah, I know.
That's when it starts to get a little iffy.
Well, I'm planning to put John Larson into day treatment anyway, so he's coming up later on, but... no, we're not putting that call on the air. Forget it. Forget it. That call's not going on there.
It probably won't.
No, that won't be going on there.
Yeah. What's on my mind about this? It doesn't really matter.
They're probably more important than that even question for us to make up my mind about. I'm very worried about Bill Tush, however. Maybe we should call him back, see how he's doing.
Then again, maybe not.
Do we have the number of the call?
Bruce and Colin shall return.
I swear to God, pathetic middle-aged people like me probably took down a communications grid today trying to speed dial at 10 o'clock for Simon and Garfunkel tickets, and that's so sad. I mean, I'm part of this. I'm part of the problem. I acknowledge that. But we should get lives or something. But, I mean, first of all, these guys, you know, I mean, I'm sure they'll be great and stuff like that. But
isn't one of them 80 now?
No, they're both 61, I think. They're both 61 years old.
Well, that's not bad.
But Putin tells me it's all happening at the zoo. I do believe it. I do believe it. Yeah, no, I'm sure fine. And I... my disoil... Well, we should make a decision just came in, but our news director, Jenna Whalen.
I thought she had some other title.
A woman. She's a woman. Is brought us this bulletin saying that Ted Turner has taken a small step to demonstrate his belief that women should run the world because men have, quote, mucked it up with too much warfare and military spending. He's established, he established a foundation to distribute $1 billion he pledged to the U.N., has a new female-dominated board of directors. I've said for years, I'm really serious about it. I think men should be barred from holding public office for 100 years. And so he's put the control of his foundation where his mouth is. And I think he sort of has a point. I mean, I hate to sort of rule all men out, but, you know, estrogen is probably a safer, more sensible chemical than testosterone. And, look around here.
You're giving me correct dosages.
Yeah, look around here. We have four stations that are ably run by Suzanne McDonald. Our immediate boss is Janine Lee. Our news director is Dana Whalen. Those parts of our operation.
Might I also remind you that we do have Salhaney in the middle.
Well, I was coming to that. That, you know, all the things that I just named are ably managed in a fairly even-tempered way.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Whereas the things that the men run around here, like the engineering is run by Gene Faltus, well, I mean, you know. You might as well have a Rwandan silverback gorilla running our engineering. For all the sense and sensibility that emerges. Really. And Salhaney's the same way. I mean, it's really just, you know, like a chimp with a bunch of firecrackers. I mean... Those parts of the operations are not well run. They're run according to the ebb and flow of the respective testosterone levels of those two people. And so they, you know, they vacillate wildly between aggressive overmanagement and complete inattention. Those are the only two states that either one of those people has. And I would also like to point out that when men had other jobs at these radio stations, comparable to the one that Suzanne has right now, for example, or comparable to the one that Janine has right now, those were a complete zoo, too. or just handled so viciously as to, you know, represent, you know...
I have no idea what you mean.
I mean, at one point we had Rasputin running this radio station. Really, I mean, honestly.
Oh, God, just tee it up.
Well, no, when Obi-Wan was running the station, I mean, really, you just, you know, your life in your hands every day coming in here. The idea of a performance review was somebody shooting you in the neck with a Kirari-tipped dart and dragging you out to the car to the parking garage and beating you. So, yes, I would say having women run things is better. At least in my own personal experience, things are run better when they are run by women.
Uh-huh.
Because women have other states of consciousness besides aggression and complete blithering inattention.
Okay.
You're not being very helpful. You're not saying anything. You're just letting me dig this big hole.
I would agree with everything that you said.
Okay.
Although I don't know that necessarily dragging past performances into this whole thing was
necessary.
Well,
the past performance is the best example.
Just because we had a few people here, made a few mistakes here and there. I mean, you know, that's the way it goes.
We had people running this stage, this place that made Bokassa look like Gandhi.
All right, so they made a lot of mistakes. But, I mean, about it anyway.
You know, we had people running this place that would make Idi Amin look like Jimmy Carter.
Are you done?
Yeah, I'm done.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, I would say that Dana Whalen, a woman...
Yeah.
Runs our news operation and does a fine job and doesn't insult or abuse people, nor does she completely turn her brain off from time to time because she's thinking about sex and sports, but in fact sort of stays in the picture the entire time. That's a good point.
What are you saying, Salhaney and Faltus think about sex and
I
sports?
I don't know. I wouldn't even want to I wouldn't want a download of what's going on up there. You know, I think we're lucky if it's just Wrecking Sports. All right.
Bruce and Colin shall return
to relaunch your love.
Probably.
That's going to be my new single, by the way.
Relaunch my love?
Yeah. Joe Lieberman and I are releasing the single, Relaunch Your Love. Relaunch Your Love to me, baby. For the people that don't know, Joe Lieberman, we launched this campaign right now. And we're actually...
I don't understand what this relaunch is.
We're actually in hour seven of the relaunch right now, in case you're wondering. And Splashdown should be right after those South Carolina primaries, I would guess. anyway, and remember, relaunching means never having to re-sign that I re-suck.
If you're like most people...
Perfect. I'm very pleased with this one.
Good.
This is Dear Mr. Ambrosio.
Yes.
I have read a lot about black holes and have gained wisdom of the subject. My question is, are there such things in outer space as white holes? And if so, well, what do they do?
Oh, white holes have the direct opposite from black holes. The white holes that are in outer space don't suck things into them like black holes do on planet Earth. But they emit objects. They emit stars. They emit... In fact, Halley's Comet was originally emitted from a white hole in space. It was shot out from the white hole and is now the legendary Halley's Comet that we've all grown to know and love.
Like go in the black hole and then get
the
white hole?
It's not like it's not a circular hole type of thing.
Okay.
But the white hole, there are items are emitted, stars, clouds. In fact, weather has certainly come out of the white hole. In fact, many people feel some weather men may have been spewed out of a white hole from one time or another. But no, white holes, there are white holes that have the distinct opposite attraction of the black holes on Earth. As you know, as we talked about earlier, we had a black hole question earlier.
Right.
I believe in May, mm-hmm. I'd ask Mr. Ambrosio, which I think resulted in the 3-day vacation for Mr. Ambrosio.
Right. So we're all done here anyway.
So yes, white holes are good.
Okay.
You know? And there's some black holes on planet Earth that serve a positive purpose. But we won't get into that at this time. Because the FCC license is up for renewal.
Another reason to celebrate Thanksgiving. I'm not getting into it.
Then Colin shall return.
It's a privilege to work with somebody like this. Somebody with a grasp of the medium. It's
amazing, isn't it?
It's like working with William Paley in the early days of CBS. That's what I would compare it to anyway. Steve Salhaney.
He's got a grip on things.
He came up to us today and he said...
I said the big story today would be the Red Sox-Yankees. You might have a few extra days to work with that one. And the California election, and then the Krug case.
Yeah.
He said, you...
All over it.
You fascinate me. The way you get to the heart, figure out what those stories are. Because you know what? I look at the newspaper, and it's just a blur of letters to me.
Right, exactly.
I look at the front page, and it all blurs together, and I can't, you know, on my head starts to spin, I can't pick out one story from the other.
Four national...
I realize this is an enormously boring topic.
Which one?
Medicare.
Oh.
I mean, I'm bored by it. I don't even want to talk about it very much. But
unfortunately, it's an important topic.
Let me just explain this the way I understand it. And believe me, I mean, I haven't immersed myself in this the way probably I should have. And it just is so mind-numbing.
You've been listening to Nancy Johnson on the Vice Fit show today. You had all the answers. You wouldn't have to be sitting here
believe
saying.
Believe me, I at least can sit here and say with tremendous confidence, that's a lot of hogwash. All right? I mean, you know, just that you can pretty much dismiss out of hand. Now, let me just sort of address what I mean, I think Ron is wrong, and I don't even know what Ron's talking about. And I mean, he's a nice guy and stuff like that, but he spends too much time listening to the station. I mean, I have to assume that he's...
Wait a minute.
What?
Wait a minute, what do you mean? He spends too much time listening to the
station. He's on every freaking show. I mean, he calls his Ray and Diane, he calls his Vice of it, he calls this show, he probably calls Sports Talk.
No,
I'm assuming he's like...
Sports Talk? Oh, Ron?
He like hangs out with Vice of it. I'm assuming he's like paralyzed and there's like a monkey feeding him grapes or something, you know what I mean? Who would listen to that station that much?
What would, just out of curiosity, would you do if that were actually true?
Well, I feel bad.
Yeah.
But he's hanging out with Vice Fit, so I'm assuming it's not true.
He's hanging out?
He's hanging out with Vice Fit.
With Vice Fit?
Yeah, they hang out. Well, now here's the thing.
That's a frightening thought.
The...
Isn't it?
Yeah, it is a frightening thought. Let me just say, this is what Ron's saying.
We're whiskey and beer, the red carson, the square.
But Artie and Fax, what you done, we'll tell. With Shorty and Chadley, they bother poor Adley. We were scared once in the double cell.
I had a day of Scottish music writing out to show solidarity with fellow Scottish Americans who are currently persecuted in the press. But a stringy hair of wild-eyed Herod and Susan Bicho
it. They skip it and love it. When tired, they shook hands and then aimed at
the... I'm not sure it's the proper... Yes, sure. For people who are wondering what I'm talking about, in a category of people that would probably include me, it is true that according to Connecticut Political Watch, one of my favorite weblogs, as you look through the 2003 copy of the Connecticut State Register and Manual, otherwise known as the Blue Book, blue is in the color you paint your faces when you go to do battle with your oppressors. You see if you can find any reference to the state's official tartan, which was ordinarily depicted in the Blue Book back in the good old days before the persecution of Scots in the state. There was some showing of the tartan. But certainly it's not
there. The 99 book.
Mm. Oh, yeah. You probably can find the tartan in there, yeah. While the sperm whale throbbing mountain laurel, praying mantis, you brunt these giganteous garnet and eastern oyster have found their respective place in the Blue Book. Sadly left lying on the editing room floor is our beloved state tartan. And then we have a quote from Larry Tarantino, somebody with whom we have dealt with in the past. He's Susan Bicho, which is a spokesperson. The tartan, he wouldn't speak in that accent. The tartan was the victim of an editing decision. If we had added the tartan to the list of state things, we would have had to add another piece of paper to the printing process, which would have caused four pages to be added to the Blue Book. Well, that's true. That's true. If you'd added the tartan to the Blue Book, but not cut anything else. But there are things there that could be cut, including a picture of Susan Bicewicz.
No.
She could have taken a hit for the tartan, but did she? No.
Where would this thing be located?
Did she ever get... It's almost there is a little thing of state things we in the back
Got
of
it.
In the wee
Got
back
it.
Of the book. So anyway, basically, we're urging Scottish Americans not to vote for Susan Bicewicz.
That's good.
And since he makes this right, since he appears on, I don't know what, the state lottery drawing, dressed in a kilt. What else do we want her to do?
I don't...
What would constitute restitution? She should have to be on the state lottery program, the little thing where they have the little ping pong balls pop out and stuff like that. They pick their lottery numbers.
Yeah.
She should be dressed in full Scottish reveal, a kilt and a tam, and possibly carrying bagpipes.
That's not enough.
That's not enough.
No.
But it's a start.
It's a start.
It's a beginning.
I'll give you a step.
If I am so thoroughly alienated and populated, an ethnic population, a treasure to,
How
you know...
How big of an ethnic population would you say?
There's loads of them. There's loads of them.
Right.
I mean, they don't call a lot of attention to themselves because it's so gloomy. And they're so cheap that they probably wouldn't actually contribute to her campaign anyway. So in terms of the coffers going down, offending Scots is
perhaps that was the way it was analyzed.
Yeah, maybe that was maybe that was exactly what you're thinking.
You know, if you gotta sacrifice something, go with something
right.
that somebody
that's
not gonna
make a lot of these people anyway.
Right.
So. So maybe it wasn't so much the votes, it was the money that she was thinking. And but anyway, we feel anyway that although Scottish people are gloomy and cheap, that's no reason to treat them like second-class citizens, all right? And I mean, I personally am not Scottish, but, you know, some people are, and they can't help it, all right? So it seems only proper, it seems only decent. To treat the lowest among us the same way you would treat the highest among us. So,
what's the new attitude we've developed here?
Yeah.
Oh.
And so it seems to me restitution is in order. And this idea that the tartan, the state tartan, is dispensable. Well, it's despicable is what it is. Mm. Anyway, if any Scottish Americans are offended or would like to be offended, our numbers are 522-WTIC. Well, what is he? Not a Scottish American. 522-WTIC.
No,
barely even a human. 522-WTIC. 1-800-966-WTIC, star WTIC.
Isn't Helmecki Scottish?
No, he's Polish.
Don't even start.
No, he probably is Scots. Maybe there's some kind of war we don't know about between Poland and Scotland. We should ask him about
that,
actually.
The Scott-Polish encounter?
That's right.
Of 1878 or something?
Some little pitched battle we were unaware of.
They fought it out with accordions and bagpipes. But
the Scotto Polo encounter.
But anyway, we've got that. Also, I hope today that I can have some conversations with some moviegoers from this weekend about the movie that currently fascinates me, Bad Santa. I thought you didn't have to see Bad Santa this weekend.
Gee, I missed it.
Bad Santa is a really hot button kind of movie. I mean, it is. I was sitting there laughing so hard that tears were streaming down my cheeks. But I was also aware that I was laughing at things that I should not be laughing at, and that really this movie is incredibly dark. It's an incredibly dark but incredibly funny meditation on the darkest kinds of alcoholism in particular. It's much more of a movie about alcoholism than you might guess, even just from watching the trailers and stuff like that. But and about the causes of alcoholism and stuff like that. But boy, is it funny. And my son, who I should not have taken to the movie, but who was in fact anyway seeing it for the second time, said I was laughing louder than anybody else in the movie theater. Now, not everybody had that reaction. For example, the humorless retired athlete Rebecca Lobo Russian did not happen to find this movie funny. I didn't go to the movie.
I thought she did find it. The other one, Elf.
Yeah, she liked Elf, but she didn't like this movie. And we've had a sharp exchange of emails about it today. Anyway, we have Amy from Bristol who would like to talk about this.
Hey, guys.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Good. Well, anyhow, Colin, thank you very much. I've always been cheap, and I've always wondered where I got it from. So there we go. I'm Scottish, and I guess I explained it.
It's got a natural ethnic sense of parsimony.
Also, I have been accused of being pretty gloomy. So
yeah. There
we go again. I'll just blame it on my heritage.
I'm afraid it's a life sentence last.
Also, additionally, in regards to the tartans,
yeah. For
those of us who are Scottish, a lot of us do know our tartans, and they're pretty easy to find. But my grandmother, she has the tartan in her house, and whenever we find it, we always collect those. And, yeah, we come from Dunbar, Scotland, and it's just a pretty neat thing.
Right, absolutely. And that's another part of your ethnic heritage, is long-winded stories about tartans.
Mm-hmm.
So you're living the life. You're living your ethnicity right up to your fingertips.
There we go,
right.
Exactly.
Okay, bye.
The cheapness and all.
Right.
Have a good day, guys.
Some long, pointless stories about bits of cloth.
Stop it. Good to see the holiday season is in full swing now. I was just talking to Joanne, our receptionist. Someone threw a rock through her window of her car, so.
That's unfortunate.
Ho, ho, ho.
Ho, ho, ho.
The merriment begins.
We have Sean in his car with a report about the Scottish flag.
Sean?
Hey, how you doing?
Fine.
What do you think you're saying, making fun of Scottish people like that?
I'm not making fun of them.
Oh, there you go. All right, I thought I was kind of curious if the tartan was taken out, and I was wondering why my vice versa have done that, if it is indeed a true story.
No, the Secretary of the State is not Susan Vicevich, it's Susan Vicevich.
There's a big difference.
it was my accent.
That's right. Susan Vicevich actually is this character that Jim Vicevich dresses up as sometimes.
Yeah, okay.
It's similar to what Pat Buchanan does when he dresses up as a woman and calls himself Bay.
Yes.
Same kind of thing. I guess there's a Scott. Isn't Buchanan? Are Buchanan Scottish?
Irish, I believe.
No, that's all right. No, we can't blame it on that, though. All right, anyway. Yes, apparently it is true. And if anyone would like to know more about this, there's a terrific website that a lot of people don't know about called ctpoliticalwatch.blogspot.com. If you go there, you can find out more information about the persecution of Scottish Americans here in the state of Connecticut by the Secretary of State. And I would imagine Amnesty International and you know, the Scottish Anti-Defamation League and various other organizations will be getting involved fairly soon. And I would say, unless something can be done to remedy this, a bagpipe picketing kind of thing, you know, outside the state capitol would seem in order.
It's going to get very ugly.
Would seem minimally in order.
Yeah.
It'll get ugly if I have anything to say about it, it'll get very ugly.
Yeah, I have a feeling you probably stirred up most of this too, right?
No, I'm not.
I think it would have just very casually passed and no one would have noticed it.
I was as surprised as the next person to read about this today, but you'd have to talk to the CT Political Watch guy to find out what was in his heart.
Yeah.
But anyway, our numbers are 522-WTIC, 1-800-966-WTIC, and if you have an interesting reaction to saying. I saw Love Actually and Bad Santa, two Christmas movies. One of them, Love Actually, is a very charming and kind of funny Christmas movie. Bad Santa is the least charming movie I've ever seen in my life, and I laughed so hard I thought I was going to die.
I got to go see it now.
And I feel bad about many of the things that I laughed at, because they are, it is an evil, 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 evil movie. It is so evil you can't believe it. But as a result, I find it quite funny. There's also, I guess we have to go to a break right now. There's a very disturbing story. Did Bobby Sherwood show you this story about how the fire department...
A Christmas Carol at Hartford Stage is sponsored by Robinson & Cole LLP, with additional support from the Hartford Current.
If you're listening, this is how a Scotsman fights back.
You know something?
Will that be a lot of flag of treason and persecution for a long season?
I think there are a lot of people you could take on in this manner, and it would be, you know, you might have the upper hand. But in this case, I think you're biting off something that...
We Scottish Isles, she'll snap like a twig.
Yeah.
Not like a twig and a sapling right outside.
I really hope she is listening, or for that matter, if she's not listening, maybe somebody who is would maybe like give her a call or something.
Lackey Larry Pelletier.
No. Big Larry? Yeah. Oh, no, that's another guy. That was Big Drunk Larry. That was a different guy.
All right, should we talk to you, some of these callers?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Fred in the car. Fred.
Hey, I saw that trailer this weekend. Absolutely hilarious. But I don't know what was funnier. I think the reactions of the blue-haired little ladies that were sitting in the row in front of me to some of the lines were just as priceless as the movie itself.
I mean, it's almost impossible to convey to somebody who hasn't seen the movie how completely objectionable this movie is on virtually every possible count.
I mean, this movie is so offensive that you could actually hear these ladies' jaws hit the floor, I think, at two or three different times in the film.
The thing is, in a weird way, it is going to... I mean, Deb Hornblow said this on her Thanksgiving show, that this movie is going to become sort of a Christmas classic, but only with a certain segment of the population, and then everybody else will, like, not be able to watch it.
Yeah, I'm ready to see it again.
I mean, it's almost as if, like, you know, It's a Wonderful Life had this big chainsaw massacre scene in the middle of it or something. I mean, this is like this Christmas classic that people will not be able to watch. But I will be seeing it the second time, I can guarantee you. Thank you, Fred. We also have Peter from Middlefield.
Peter?
Oh, hi, guys. I enjoy your show. Listening and watching The Bad Santa, it was a study in contrast, I thought, and very understated performances. John Ritter, and also the young man, the kid.
The little boy, yeah.
Yeah, he was phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, he was just phenomenal. And, you know, what was the thing with the sandwiches? With Grandma.
There are a lot of things in the movie that are never really quite explained. For example, the kid keeps referring to the talking walnut, which I think is sort of his idea of God and stuff, but I don't know. But let me just say this also. I think Billy Bob Thornton's performance is also very understated, even though, you know, he does every possible weird, objectionable thing in the world. It's kind of funny, because when we walked out of the movie theater, I saw this with my imaginary son and one of his friends, and so as we walked out of the movie theater, I immediately began talking to them in the same kind of, you know, profane, horrible way that Billy Bob Thornton talks to children in the movie in order to make them laugh. And my son immediately said to me, you know, he doesn't do it that loudly or aggressively. I mean, which is true. I mean, for all of the really dramatic shock effect of that movie, most of what Billy Bob Thornton says, he kind of mutters under his breath, and he speaks very softly most of the time.
And he comes at the end of the movie almost as a... I don't want to say heroic, but certainly there is some redeeming quality at the end when Mrs. Santa's sister is there at the house now. And
you can't even say these things without laughing.
I thought it was phenomenally funny.
We have to apologize to people who haven't seen the movie, because the minute you start talking about the movie, you start mentioning things that will actually make you laugh. I'm a tough laugh in movie theaters. I mean, I really don't laugh real hard at most movies. I mean, even movies that are pretty funny, I don't laugh out loud at. I'm an easy cry in a movie theater. Like, I cried at Love Actually.
I would have liked to have seen that, actually.
I cried three or four
times.
You
crying on the movie.
Yeah, I cried.
Do you blubber a lot? I mean,
little tears
coming down?
Yeah.
What's it take to get you really blubbering? I mean, really get you going?
We'd have to think, like, emotion in football. Like, Remember the Titans? I cried really hard at that
one.
Have you ever seen that movie?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, I could die by a weapon that. But so, Just the thought of actually spending a night with Bobby and Mikey C. at there, that would make me cry. Just even the thought of it. Never mind.
I think you're way past that, I think.
Anyway, do we have to go? Or
yes, we do. All right, we'll 329, we're Bruce and Colin. When you purchased, where did that wreath come from, by the way?
I don't know.
Was that there a few minutes ago?
I don't know. They asked me not to talk to you about it.
They asked you not to talk to me about it?
About the wreath, yeah. If he still wonders where the wreath comes, came from, don't say anything. That's what they told me. The men told me that. The men who put up the wreath. They said, don't say it, don't tell.
First of all, when did you ever do anything that anybody told you to do, number one?
That's probably true. That's why I'm talking to you right now, actually. I wanted to mention something for the New York Times. New York Times Sunday Magazine did this very interesting... New York Times Sunday Magazine did this very interesting special issue about design. And I must say that in general, for most of my life, I've not been interested in design. But lately I am for some reason. I'm not exactly sure why it is. It's got something to do with my whole sort of queer eye for the straight guy vibe that I've got going on right now.
Oh, God.
And it's got something to do with my apartment. And it's got something... I'm not sure, but I'm now interested in design, which is neither here nor there.
Design inside the apartment?
Well, I'm interested in design in general. I'm interested
in interior decorating.
Well, I'm interested in, and this is a special issue of the New York Times Sunday Magazine that's kind of all about why things look the way they look, and they have designers redesigning, existing things, and they also have analyses of how things get designed the way they are. Including
you want to get out of that real fast?
Mm-hmm.
Watch the Home and Garden Network on TV for a while.
Mm.
My wife watches this incessantly. And after a while, guarantee you won't be interested in this anymore.
Well, at the moment I am. This was a very interesting issue, and they just said they even analyzed the design of, for example, the blister Band-Aid and SpongeBob SquarePants and the U.S. $20 bill and stuff like that. But there was quite an interesting article on the iPod. Now, the iPod is
SpongeBob?
Yeah. The design of, well, what? Somebody had to sit down and design SpongeBob SquarePants.
Yeah, but...
You know, and he's incredibly popular. Why wouldn't it be interesting to know how he was designed?
I never had given it a thought.
Yeah, well, that's what the New York Times Sunday Magazine is for, is to help you give it a thought. Well, anyway.
We're a little snippy, aren't we?
Well, no, I'm just trying to explain this to you.
Okay.
So anyway, a very interesting article about the iPod. Now, the iPod, for people that don't know.
Thick, too, you know.
I know. I'm sympathetic. I feel your pain. I feel your mucus, even.
Certainly hope not.
The iPod, for people who don't know what it is Apple's sort of unit for candidates, even. And they turn leading designers loose on, for example, the Joe Lieberman mystique and stuff like that. So
the what?
The Joe Lieberman mystique. They actually have...
Mistake? Did you say or mystique?
Mystique. Or either one. They got a firm called Bonnie Siegler and Emily Overman. They're partners in the design firm Number 17. And they were recently hired to recreate the magazine colors, and they have designed for Saturday Night Live and HBO. So they designed these kind of silhouetted posters for Joe Lieberman. One of them says Joe Lieberman, the conservative moderate, and the other one says Joe Lieberman, the moderate conservative. And they're quoted as saying, first we wanted to make Lieberman look presidential, so we decided to do the old shadow silhouette. The other one says, we also wanted him to make him look a little more groovy, a little more cool. We wanted to address an audience of people who might be hesitant about him because of his stiffness. And we realized we could reference this amazing piece of culture, Milton Glaser's Dylan poster, and reinvent it in a modern and political way. So we did a patriotic Lieberman-esque version of that poster. And you don't have to teach people a new language to read it. Even if some people don't get the reference, we felt it communicated this presidential / coolness that Lieberman needs to project. Oh, does he ever. Depending on how you spin this, you can either create a completely new personality or enhance a personality. Here, we're enhancing. We think all these things are already here in Lieberman, but people may not know about them. I think he has a little of that Al Gore stiff problem. You don't say.
Ha.
But anyway, they took this kind of 60s style Dylan wavy groovy American flag thing. And superimpose it on Joe Lieberman and stuff like that.
So yeah, that's...
people who want to look at that.
Nice, but I don't
know. I don't think it would actually be the Lieberman poster of the future, but if you want to look at it, it's in the New York Times, and they're very interesting. All design section.
Happy holidays from Men's Warehouse. Call 1-800-776-SUITS.
Bruce and Colin shall return.
Let's talk to Joy, because I'm depressed.
All right. Joy.
Hi, Joy.
Bruce and Colin.
Yeah, I'm not depressed anymore.
I love you. I'm the cheerleading commuter.
Yeah.
I'm commuting from Norwalk to Simsbury.
Man, I want whatever you're taking. I just want to say that.
Well, I'm listening to you. That's what I do. You know why I'm so happy?
Yeah.
Because you have no idea how you have made the terrific drive.
You should get one of those. You should get one of those cars that plays with your ass. You'd really enjoy your drive.
The SBC SNET Yellow Pages is just.
I just want to explain very quickly, put in context that little clip that we just played of that conversation with Joy. Because on that particular day, Bill Heald, the gentleman biker, had been here with this unbelievably expensive BMW, a BMW from something that cost more than most people's houses did. And so we all went for a little ride in it, or at least Bill Heald and Kerry Scheinberg and I went out riding in this car. And the seat that I sat in had this little thing where a little control that you could touch where the car would really begin to grope you, basically. I mean, the car would just basically begin kind of groping your bottom.
Like a Schwarzenegger seat?
Yeah, I guess it was supposed to be a massage component or something, but the car was basically playing with my ass. Which was fine, except that, you know, seems to be I don't know. It's all getting kind of impersonal. You know, they got that, then they got the robot that goes inside you. And these things used to be done by human strangers, not by machines.
Well, the robots run by machines.
These things used to be done by people in bus stations, you know, with dirty raincoats, not by machines. Anyway, our numbers are 522-WTIC, 1-800-966-WTIC, star WTIC.
Here is Josh in Hartford. Josh.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. Going okay.
Hey, I just wanted, Terry Zwigoff, the director of Bad Santa, I mean, this guy's breaking new ground in black comedy, I think.
He's a great director. He directed Ghost World and he directed Crumb, right?
Yeah, exactly. And with this movie, I think he's really creating a new genre of neo-black comedy. It's very exciting, I think.
I would agree. I think this movie, in some weird way, is kind of like an important movie. It's difficult to believe that a movie in which so many really completely foul and objectionable things could be an important movie, but I think it is somehow. But I have a question about what place this movie can occupy in the culture, because it's a movie that a lot of people are going to want to see, like, every year at Christmas time, kind of the way people want to see It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, it's all about isolationism, how we're all disconnected from one another.
Well, it's also a movie about all the things that people didn't get from Christmas. I mean, everybody in the movie is struggling with some kind of gigantic vacuum, which turns out to be traceable back to things that didn't go well in their childhoods, but specifically things that they didn't get at Christmas time.
Like the Santa fetish.
Well, yes, there's a woman, there's a barmaid who in particular needs to have a certain kind of relationship with Santa now, because in fact her childhood she didn't get that, or she didn't get what she needed from Santa back then, and now she needs something different from him.
Exactly.
But it is going to be a movie that people want to see at Christmas time again and again and again, like It's a Wonderful Life, except that Jimmy Stewart doesn't get so drunk in It's a Wonderful Life that he
pees
in his pants.
And the kids' noses don't run.
Right. Anyway, thanks very much for your call.
Yeah.
Minute?
Yep.
I just want to quickly mention this kind of amazing story about, you know, Saddam Hussein apparently had been trying to buy a complete missile production system from North Korea.
Yep.
And made a $10 million down payment. And then, at which point, Kim Jong-il said that the United States was watching too closely and sort of said, whoops. Can't really do it. Can't really quite work this out. I'm really sorry about that, but it just, you know, they're watching us too closely, and I just don't think I can sell you. I don't think I can deliver this missile production system.
So I gave the money back.
Sorry.
Right?
Sorry.
So I gave the money back.
No, apparently it takes a homicidal megalomaniac madman to fleece a homicidal megalomaniac madman. So I don't know whether we should feel good or bad about this, but $10 million changed hands in a particular way. I'd rather see Saddam Hussein have the $10 million, because I always thought he was less dangerous, even back when he was in charge of Iraq. The idea that Kim Jong-il is $10 million richer doesn't actually make me sleep a lot better.
Bruce and Colin shall return. I think the problem is that for the most part, there aren't music radio stations that play a lot of this stuff.
No, that's right.
Like, you release a new Sting CD, and maybe 96.5 will play it. And maybe if there's a slow enough sleep-inducing song somewhere on the Sting CD,
100.5
will play it. If there's nothing that would possibly cause anybody's neurons to crackle even the tiniest bit with consciousness, then maybe 100.5 would play it. You know, I would try to listen to music radio around here, and really, I was recital by the end of the week.
they're in the river, it's just like, you know, the ball, the, it's like the Billy Joel song you hate. It's not even the Billy Joel song you like.
When the time comes. I just wanted to mention, because not that I have an interesting anecdote to tell about it, as a matter of fact, for the opposite reason, because I have no interesting anecdotes to tell about it, and because I am proud of how boring I've become on this subject, I did hot room yoga today. Thank you. I think, you know, I think when we reach a certain age in life, I'm 49, I think that there are only one or two subjects in which we're almost federally mandated, not merely empowered, not merely permitted, but federally mandated to develop a couple of subjects on which we are almost cosmically tiresome about. And for me, hot room yoga would be one of those. I do enjoy it, but I don't have anything interesting to say about it, because that really has changed my life. I'm a much more rooted person. I'm a much more heart-centered person, and I think you would have to say, working with me, that I'm just in touch with my heart these days.
Yeah, I would say that. What specifically, I'm going to hate myself here. What specifically do you do during these yoga get-togethers?
I curl up and cry, but the other people do their yoga exercises. Hot room yoga, which is, in fact, was created by somebody named Bikram. And then Bikram tried to trademark his own name or something like that, so you can't call it Bikram anymore unless you pay Bikram some money or something. So most everybody calls it hot room yoga and just does it differently. But they get that room, as you might guess, really, really hot. And then you do these difficult exercises, most of which I can't do. I can, being an Irish American, 49 years old, I can bend my body maybe 3 to 4 degrees in any particular direction. I have almost...
Yeah, that's the point of doing this, so that you'll get more flexibility?
Yeah, I'm up to maybe 6 or 7 degrees. And actually, the instructor, who is great, I love my yoga instructor, will actually come and kind of press on my body when it's in certain posture. Because, you know, everybody else is sort of, will be sort of curled up into these little, you know, complicated pretzel-like shapes. And I'll be sort of this kind of lump. It's not that different from the lump that I am most of the time, but maybe just bent over a little bit more. And he actually will come and press on my body to see whether to see whether it can be slightly moved a tiny bit more. And then it turns out it can. And then sometimes the other people just pile coats on me and stuff like that. You know,
so you're a glorified coat rack.
Yeah, they don't want to have to look at me while they're doing their... But it is afterwards, I do feel, even though if you were to watch me do hot room yoga, you would think that I was like a conscientious objector to yoga, that I was actually there to, you know, to stand kind of still and not do the exercises as a form of protest. But I'm actually doing the exercises as best I can. But afterwards, I do feel cleansed. I feel better. I feel calmer. I feel my heart is full of more charitable impulses. My chakras are more chakrified. More chocolate covered, and I feel like a being of light and sexually pure.
Bruce and Colin shall return.
A little bit later in the show today, I'd like to actually talk about this case that Matt Dwyer reported on earlier today about the 75-year-old pimp.
I think you should.
Also,
got a prostitution ring going on there.
Yeah. And he's 35-year-old, and I guess they released him from prison because of his bad health, but it's pretty impressive, actually.
I would think that would not be the kind of thing you'd want to run.
Hey, yeah, you're looking for some action? I've got a girl upstairs, looks like Rita Hayworth. I'm trying to keep up with the time.
Here is the...
You're looking for a little fun.
Colin shall return.
Let's talk to Joy, because I'm depressed.
All right. Joy.
Hi, Joy.
Bruce and Colin.
Yeah, I'm not depressed anymore.
I love you. I'm the cheerleading commuter.
Yeah.
I'm commuting from Norwalk to Simsbury.
Man, I want whatever you're taking. I just want to say that.
Well, I'm listening to you. That's what I'm doing. You know why I'm so happy?
Yeah.
Because you have no idea how you have made a terrific drive.
You should get one of those. You should get one of those cars that plays with your ass. You'd really enjoy your drive.
The SBCS.
I just want to explain very quickly, put in context that little clip that we just played of that conversation with Joy, which is on that particular day, Bill Heald, the gentleman biker, had been here with this unbelievably expensive BMW, a BMW from something, something, something that cost more than most people's houses did. And so we all went for a little ride in it, or at least Bill Heald and Carrie Scheinberg and I went out riding in this car, and the seat that I sat in had this little thing where a little control that you could touch where the car would really begin to
grope you, basically. I mean, the car would just basically begin kind of groping your bottom.
Like
I guess
Schwarzenegger seat?
Yeah, I guess it was supposed to be a massage component or something, but the car was basically playing with my ass. Which was fine, except that, you know, seems to me, I don't know. It's all getting kind of impersonal. You know, they got that, and they got the robot that goes inside you. And these things, these things used to be done by human strangers, not by machines.
The robots run by machines.
These things used to be done by people in bus stations, you know, with dirty raincoats. Not by machines. Anyway, our numbers are 522-WTIC, 1-800-966-WTIC, *WTIC. Coming up later on the show today, we have
Josh and Hartford. Josh.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. Going okay.
Hey, I just wanted, Terry Zwigoff, the director of Bad Santa, I mean, this guy's breaking new ground in black comedy, I think.
He's a great director. He directed Ghost World and he directed Crumb, right?
Yeah, exactly. And with this movie, I think he's really creating a new genre of neo-black comedy. It's very exciting, I think.
I would agree. I think this movie, in some weird way, is kind of like an important movie. It's difficult to believe that a movie in which so many really completely foul and objectionable things could be an important movie, but I think it is somehow. But I have a question about what place this movie can occupy in the culture, because it's a movie that a lot of people are going to want to see, like, every year at Christmas time, kind of the way people want to see It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, it's all about isolationism, how we're all disconnected from one another.
Well, it's also a movie about all the things that people didn't get from Christmas. I mean, everybody in the movie is struggling with some kind of gigantic vacuum, which turns out to be traceable back to things that didn't go well in their childhoods, but specifically things that they didn't get at Christmas time.
Like the Santa fetish.
Well, yes, there's a woman, there's a barmaid who in particular needs to have a certain kind of relationship with Santa now, because in fact her childhood she didn't get that, or she didn't get what she needed from Santa back then, and now she needs something different from him.
Exactly.
But it is going to be a movie that people want to see at Christmas time again and again and again, like It's a Wonderful Life, except that Jimmy Stewart doesn't get so drunk in It's a Wonderful Life that he's in his pants.
And the kids' noses don't run.
Right. Anyway, thanks very much for your call.
All right, a couple of minutes before 4, and 522-WTIC, 800-966-WTIC.
So, Cody mentioned this kind of amazing story about, you know, Saddam Hussein apparently had been trying to buy a complete missile production system from North Korea.
Yep.
And made a $10 million down payment. And then, at which point, Kim Jong-il said that the United States was watching too closely and sort of said, whoop, can't really do it. Can't really quite work this out. I'm really sorry about that, but it's just, you know, they're watching us too closely, and I just don't think I can sell you. I don't think I can deliver this missile production system.
So I gave the money back.
Sorry.
Right? Sorry. So I gave the money back.
No, apparently it takes a homicidal megalomaniac madman to fleece a homicidal megalomaniac madman. So I don't know whether we should feel good or bad about this, but $10 million changed hands in a particular way. I'd rather see Saddam Hussein have the $10 million, because I always thought he was less dangerous, even back when he was in charge of Iraq. The idea that Kim Jong-il is $10 million richer doesn't actually make me sleep a lot better.
At 4:30.
It'll be a year ago Saturday that legendary WTIC announcer Bob Steele passed away. From 5:30 till 10, WTIC News Talk 1080's Arnold Dean will take a look back at what made Bob Steele so special. With his favorite songs, his funniest jokes, the word of the day, and so much more. It'll be a show you'll want to keep. So get your recorders ready to tape this special tribute. Bob Steele, In Memoriam, Saturday morning, 5:30 till 10. Hosted by Arnold Dean on WTIC News Talk 1080.
If you're responsible for buying electricity for a New England business, you're probably concerned about the cost of electricity. Constellation New Energy can help ease that concern.
Excitement tomorrow.
What's that?
Oh,
Jeff Fox.
Fox
hosting the Buddy Vizor show.
Jeff Fox will be in here.
Buddy's getting some rest. Everybody thought that was a good idea. And my understanding is that he's going to be down at Madison Square Garden tomorrow, because apparently they're using his hair to do the light settings for Art Garfunkel before he plays the Garden. So somebody else gave me that joke.
It was a little rash, but you know.
Yeah. No, the rash went away. I just want to go back to this Christine Regalia thing, because I don't want to make sure that I'm making myself understood, which would be, you know, a breakthrough.
Kind of a new thing.
Yeah. The Basically, she's got a new job. Now, this is back up. She's the, she was head of the Department of Children and Families. She left there in March. She got a job working in Blumenthal's office, which was interesting because I don't think she and Blumenthal like each other very much. But so she worked in as assistant attorney general. Now she's leaving. Now, keep in mind, no one has ever really alleged anything, any improprieties against Christine Regalia, including me. But she was sort of in the middle of a lot of this stuff. In fact, after she left DCF, weeks later, the U.S. Attorney's Office ordered that agency to turn over documents relating to the $57 million contract to build a new juvenile training school for boys. That's the one that wound up in the hands of the Tommaso Group at the recommendation of a panel that did include Regalia and top officials from Roland staff. And it seems to be, that facility seems to be one of the key projects that's somehow or other involved in all this Alabozek, Tommaso, Ellis stuff. So, and if you recall, there was a trip to go look at a comparable facility, I believe in Ohio, and she went on it, but so did one of the Tommasos, so that they knew more about what was being looked for than, you know, than other comparable competing contractors might have and stuff like that. So, you know, once again, not that she did anything wrong, but she certainly seems to have been around these projects that are, you know, part of the whole, our whole understanding of, you know, one of the corruption problems here in the state of Connecticut. Anyway, with that in mind, it's interesting to know what her new job is, and that is that she's taking over at the Department of Social Services heading up a fraud and recovery unit. It just, you know,
that's
once again,
social services, though.
Department of Social Services. Yeah. I mean, it's a different state department, but it just seemed like kind of an odd thing, you know. She will manage the fraud and recoveries unit at the State Department of Social Services, and apparently this involves once again maybe another one of these fraud lines. It's the quality control unit is charged with assuring DSS is the payer of last resort for those receiving welfare. It is also responsible for investigating client or third-party payer fraud, and it attempts to recoup benefits paid out to recipients. And as manager, she will supervise the fraud hotline.
The fraud hotline
and the tax intercept program that allows the state to seize income tax refunds for repayment for outstanding debts or benefit overpayments owed to the DSS. I just want to point out that fraud hotlines are a growth industry here in Connecticut. I mean, apparently there's one over there at DSS. And then Christopher Morano, the chief state's attorney, he recently announced the creation of the toll-free number 1-888-742-2726, reachable only in Connecticut, that allows callers to report political corruption anonymously.
Marooned in a blizzard of lies.
And joining us right now is David Korn. He's the Washington editor of The Nation. He's the author also of The Lies of George W. Bush, Mastering the Politics of Deception. He's with us now. He also, in fact, mans and operates a website called www.bushlies.com. Hello, David Korn.
Good to be with you. I love that song. I hadn't heard that one before. Often when I do these shows, they play Liar, Liar by the Castaways.
We try to be a little bit more recherche than that, if possible. That's David Frischberg, if you ever need to track it down again. And Maria Muldaur, I think, does a version of it as well. Anyway, David Korn, let's begin by saying this. You know, you listed all the lies of George W. Bush, and you've got a top 10 list on your website. Are there any new ones that you're aware of? And specifically, do you think there are any lies associated with the most recent visit to Iraq by President Bush?
Well, actually, there are. That's one thing I do on the website is I try to keep track of the latest misrepresentations or false statements from the administration. Again, that's bushlies.com. Mm-hmm. And just last week, Bush, you know, went to, before he went on the famous Thanksgiving trip, which we can get to in a moment, he went to Fort Carson, out in Colorado, and he says, we put the Taliban out of business forever. Mm-hmm. So the 5,000 troops there. Well, just 2 days beforehand, five U.S. GIs died in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan chasing after the Taliban. The Taliban has been killing U.N. refugee workers, and others in Afghanistan. The U.N. had a mission there a couple weeks ago, came back and reported that the rise in Taliban attacks was threatening democracy there. It was stopping many, many reconstruction programs. And so, I mean, it's almost too transparent a false statement to take seriously, but yet he is the commander-in-chief and the president, and to get out there and tell the public, not that we routed the Taliban and pushed them out of Kabul, but that we've put them out of business forever when American soldiers are still giving their lives in pursuit of the Taliban, I mean, it's almost staggering to me. I just don't even quite understand why he would make such a false assertion. I don't even know what it wins him, but yet there it was.
Well, also, the Taliban may be one of those organizations that's always claiming to go out of business and just to boost interest in their sales and stuff like
that.
Well,
it could be, get a better deal. But I mean, it's really, I mean, when you have American soldiers dying, you know, fighting these guys to say, we put them out of business forever? It's just, as I said, the type of transparent lie of false statement that serves no purpose and is just too easy to verify. A more sort of sophisticated falsehood, if you will, occurred when he went to Baghdad on Thanksgiving Day. And listen, I salute him for going there, for standing with the troops. You know, I think all commanders should do that. I don't think that should make us change the way we view them and their policies. But I think that's, you know, it's a good thing to do. But when he was there, he said to the GIs at the Bob Hope Mess Hall, he said, you are defeating the terrorists here in Iraq so that we don't have to face them in our own country. Now, the week before, the two top military commanders in Iraq, Major General Charles Swanick and Major General David Petraeus, said that they didn't believe they were fighting al-Qaeda loyalists or wannabes, that indeed the people they were fighting were the remnants of Iraq's former Ba'athist regime. And I don't think anyone believes that if we weren't chasing these guys in Iraq, they would be fighting us on the streets of the United States. You know, this is a very melodramatic, sort of misleading claim on Bush's part, trying to tie the war in Iraq to 9/11 by saying, listen, if we don't fight these guys there, they're going to come get us here. The people we're fighting there were not the ones who hit us on 9/11 and didn't have any real designs in terms of hitting U.S. domestic targets with terrorism. So, again, a complete gross exaggeration.
You know, there's an old-time term of art in the world of political speak called the big lie. You know, the implication being if you tell a large enough lie and you tell it often enough, it seems just a matter that it's not true. And I guess I'm wondering, is this any worse than, say, Vietnam, where just this cascade of untruths came pouring out for years and years?
Well, like, I think the key words there are years and years. Mm-hmm. I mean, we did have it for years and years. I mean, Nixon said he had a plan to end the war before he got elected, and he didn't have a plan. And there were the 5 o'clock follies, there was the daily press conference held by the military command in Vietnam, in which they said things were demonstrably untrue, trying to put the best spin on body counts and such. I mean, you add up all the body counts and we killed the VC, you know, three times over.
Mm-hmm.
It really got to be pretty ridiculous. We live in a different age of information now, but yet we still, I think human nature hasn't changed much in the last 30 years. So I'm curious to see to what degree Bush and his supporters, are able to maintain some of, the big lies or false assertions. I mean, even George Will, who's a very conservative columnist, great writer, I disagree with him about everything, did a column a couple weeks ago in which he said, isn't it time for the White House to acknowledge they were wrong about weapons of mass destruction?
Mm-hmm.
They just still don't do that. They still keep saying, well, we're going to find something. We had good, solid intelligence about this. I mean, they said that over and over again. They had good, solid intelligence. When the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who's a Republican from Kansas, Pat Roberts, a conservative, and the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, another Republican, Porter Goff, who used to be in the CIA, have reviewed the pre-war intelligence on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, and they have told the public that it was shoddy, inconclusive, fragmentary, circumstantial, and contained many uncertainties. Yet Bush continues to insist it was good, solid intelligence, and that it left no doubt that there were weapons of mass destruction. So, I mean, there's this tremendous disconnect between the rhetoric and reality, which even goes beyond whether the war in Iraq was a good thing or bad thing. And the president, so far, hasn't really had to pay a political price for that, and thus, you know, I guess you could say he's getting away with it up to now.
Do you think that there also are just no voices that anybody pays attention to anymore? I'm thinking about, you know, during Vietnam, there was sort of a big moment when Cronkite came back and said, you know, this isn't the way it is, and Brinkley wouldn't read the body count counts anymore at a certain point. And I'm not even just talking about TV journalists, but,
right.
I mean, it seems to me like if the Dalai Lama bought, you know, an hour on, you know, on primetime television and said, you know, I really don't think this administration is telling the American people the truth, I don't think it would really mean anything to anybody, because I don't think anybody has invested anyone with any kind of pure moral authority anymore.
I think that's true. I also think we live in sort of an argumentative time in which, you know, every argument gets kind of neutered by the fact that there's somebody on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, whenever Republicans say something, Democrats can just say, well, that's just Republican talking. Whenever Democrats say something, that's just Republicans can say, that's just a Democrat talking. The media, you know, is the mainstream media in general. I mean, this is a vapid generalization, but in general feels more comfortable, you know, covering the cat fight rather than explaining who might be right and who might be wrong and sort of getting to the truth of it. Of a situation, and you know, the Democratic Party, I don't think has, you know, has won over the faith and trust of the American public, you know, any more than the Republicans, so they can get out and say, listen to us, we think this is where the president's not telling the truth, and people actually believe them rather than just see it as a political attack on the on their opposition, and so I think, you know, politically there are no strong moral voices. Now it may come to pass, you know, that the TV journalists or the media reporters in general might turn on the war or sell on it in some way, as happened in Vietnam. That might have some impact here. It could well be that it comes from Republicans. You know, Senator John McCain has been very critical of some of the aspects of the war, although he supported it, as has Chuck Hagel, a Republican from Nebraska. You know, if a few prominent Republicans start speaking out against it or raising, you know, questions about certain policy matters, that, you know, might get more, throw more attention to things. But we tend to, I think the culture of debate we have in this country, you know, tends to allow a lot of people to dismiss both sides because, you know, it's like, well, it's one side versus the other, and who knows who's right.
Well, in our next segment, we'll have a Pat Buchanan with a dissenting view. No, I'm just kidding. I'm making that up. But thank you,
Pat,
David Corn,
who's been, the war.
been with us with The Lies of George W. Bush, Mastering the Politics of Deception. He's the Washington editor of The Nation. Thank you.
Thank you, and I encourage people to go check out bushlies.com.
It's a fun, it's a little recreational view on your computer. Thanks for being with us.
Part of the Northeast Utility System, paid for by NU shareholders.
Bruce and Colin shall return.
I think the problem is that for the most part there aren't music radio stations that play a lot of this stuff.
No, that's right.
Like you release a new Sting CD and maybe 96.5 will play it. And maybe if there's a slow enough sleep-inducing song somewhere on the Sting CD, 100.5 will play it. If there's nothing that would possibly cause anybody's neurons to crackle even the tiniest bit with consciousness, then maybe 100.5 would play it. You know, I would try to listen to music radio around here, and I was suicidal by the end of the week. God, I couldn't believe how bad most of it was. I mean, The River is just like, you know, it's like the Billy Joel songs you hate. It's not even the Billy Joel songs you like. And cultural correspondent Rebecca Lobo-Russian will be attending, and she'll probably give us a report on that when the time comes.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to mention, because not that I have an interesting anecdote to tell about it, as a matter of fact, for the opposite reason, because I have no interesting anecdotes to tell about it, and because I...